Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When Clive Cussler published his first novel in 1973, he knew he didn't want to write a familiar kind of character, no spy or detective or undercover investigator. His hero would have grand adventures set on or underwater. Cussler named him Dirk Pitt, and his organization, the National Underwater and Marine Agency, or NUMA, became a beloved literary series and character, and they were born. The first book was The Mediterranean Caper. It's now being published in a hardcover 40th anniversary edition with a new preface by the author, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Clive Cussler to the book show. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Oh, Joe, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's always a delight to speak to you. Is it hard for you to believe, or can you put in context 40 years?
No, it's really, I can't put it into a good context, but it's, I'm still astounded. I just, you know, when I started writing, I had no idea where it was going to go, and that I'd be around all these years, you know, comes as a surprise also.
What led you to want to write? You had a strong background in much of what you write about, but at what point did you say, okay, this is going to be the day job?
My wife decided to go back to work, and she took an interesting job with the local police department working nights, not in uniform, but, you know, dispatcher, secretary. So I'd come home, feed the kids, put them to bed, and had nobody to talk to, and just popped into my mind, gosh, I think I'll write a book. And not having the great American novel, you know, inside me, I thought it'd be fun to do a paperback series, which was popular at the time. And so I studied all the series heroes, beginning with Inspector DuPont, who was the first Edgar Allan Poe, and Sherlock Holmes and James Bond and Travis McGee and all of them. And after 4 months, I thought, well, what can I do that's different? So I took my hero and put him in and around water, and we went from there.
And your background was not naval, it was the Air Force.
Yes, I know. And that's funny, I should have made Pitt coming out of the Navy, but I had him come out of the Air Force because I was familiar with that end of it.
You write in the preface to The Mediterranean Caper in the new edition that you vividly remember telling your first story at like 4 years old.
Yes, my parents used to take me to the library and leave me when they went to town on Saturday night. And so it was just, I was very young, but I could read really well. And so I turned in a book report on Gone with the Wind. And the teacher, of course, she said, you couldn't have possibly read this book. And I said, well, I did. She called my mother, who, of course, backed me up. And she was quite surprised on that. And then I did a review on one called Hell and the Foreign Legion, and they sent me home because that was a nasty in those days. So.
When you started to write, and which fueled the other in the sense of was it a fascination with a maritime history that you wanted to explore and your novel writing allowed that, or it was through the novel writing that you became fascinated with the subject?
It was through the novel writing because I'd always been, you know, like the challenge of going out. A friend of mine and I, we used to go out in the desert and look for old lost gold mines and ghost towns and what have you. And when I read a book that said that the Bonhomme Richard, John Paul Jones ship, had never been found, it just intrigued me. So I put together an expedition, which was kind of a disaster, and then put together another one, which was much better. And then some years later, every so often, I'd go out and look. Now we've covered about 1,100 square miles, and we still haven't found it.
You look at The Mediterranean Caper. The book comes out 40 years ago. It was followed by Iceberg, and they were well received. But really, it wasn't until the third book, Raise the Titanic, that you really hit.
That was the breakthrough book, as they call it. And I remember I got $7,500 for the hardcover, and then they were going into the paperback auction, which my agent described how that works. So my wife was working at Memorex, and she walked out the door. I said, oh, when it gets up to $250,000, I'll call you and you can quit. And we had a hearty laugh over that. And at 10 o'clock, I called her and said, you can quit. And she walked right in and gave 2 weeks' notice.
Wow. And there's no figuring that out, right, as to what hits with the public, of what it is that it was about that novel.
Oh, no, it's hard to say. Well, the Titanic, of course, was with even a school child was, you know, very well known. And, you know, everyone was deepened in the mystery. And there was, like, kind of goofy talk about raising it. And I thought, well, what if they did? So I just put together a story and raised the Titanic.
Going back to the Mediterranean caper, when you read the book now and looking at this new edition, to me it's still so vibrant and it holds up so well. And being a fan of the character and of the series, it's wonderful. It had been quite some time since I had read it, so it's nice to revisit it and see how this character was born. Did you go back and read it, and what were your thoughts?
Yes, about a year ago was the first time I'd gone back and read it in 39 years. And I was surprised. I said it was better than I thought it was. So, but yeah, it was, it was just, it, I knew then I could write. But it just still was, you know, almost a wonderment to me that I could type a prologue and then type the epilogue. So it was great fun.
You write in the preface that you like to create different situations that most authors don't attempt. Instead of Pitt becoming immortal like James Bond, I've added years to his existence. We grew older together, although I age much faster than he did. When we started out together, we were both 34. Now he's around 46, and you are 82 now, so having just had a birthday. So from the beginning, and I alluded to this in the introduction, from the beginning there were things that were very stationary within the fiction world of this genre that you wanted to avoid.
Well, I wanted to make it entertaining. I wasn't thinking of making it some big erudite, you know, book. I've always considered myself more as an entertainer than just a writer. And my job is to entertain the reader in such a manner that when they reach the end of the book, they feel they got their money's worth.
The classic cars were there from the very beginning.
Yes, I was collecting, and then after about, I guess, the fifth book, I thought, gosh, Pitt and I should be driving the same car. So I had the picture taken on the back of the jacket, and I'd be standing behind whatever car that Pitt drove in the book. And at that distance, you know, nobody ever could recognize me, which was kind of fun. And it worked out very well. So, you know, it's fun to pick a car out, you know, an old car, Duesenberg or whatever, and have Pitt drive it in the book. It's great fun.
And you're in the book.
Yes, I did that. I was writing a chapter where Pitt was at a concourse with his Stutz car, a Bearcat, and he walked over to this old white-haired fellow with a beard, and he said, "Hello, my name's Dirk Pitt." And I was just typing away, and I said, "Hi, I'm Clive Cussler." And I thought, well, that was dumb. But the more I thought about it, I thought, oh, the readers would get a laugh out of it, so I left it in. And my God, I got 600 letters on that, so I have to have my little walk-on every Pitt book.
That Hitchcockian moment where you show up.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
What was the original thought from the publisher?
He wasn't happy about it, but I said, oh, what the heck, you know, it's not going to hurt anything. So, yeah, I left it in, and it's just become a tradition now.
Is it possible for you to analyze success in the sense of, we touched on this with the Titanic book, but as far as understanding what strikes a chord with readers, what it is they like about you and what it is they like about the stories that you tell?
Well, I never thought about liking me, but the stories there, again, I try to make it stories that are fascinating and interesting that the reader can really get into. And I've 15 years in advertising, I couldn't write Hemingway or Dostoevsky or any of them, but I could write so that it was very easily. Oh, my writing is very easily understood and read by children as young as 8. I know, and so it's been kind of a fun time to really just try to. Not thinking of money or anything else, but just trying to turn out a fun book for the reader.
Clive Cussler is our guest. The 40th anniversary edition of his first Dirk Pitt novel, The Mediterranean Caper, has been re-released by Putnam in hardcover. When you think of your career and you look at the stories that you tell, you frequently do take on an alternative history perspective. How did you arrive at that, of basically a curiosity that would say, what happens if they went right instead of left?
Well, trying to come up with something unique, like in Mediterranean Caper, where this old World War I airplane shows up and then strafes the hell out of an American jet base. So it was just the incongruity there and the fun part. And so I think that got me started in the history. In the prologue, and one side situation is I had an old school chum by the name of Lee Hunt, and in every prologue, they'd find a body or there'd be a ship embedded in ice and then the dead sailors or something, but there was always a Lee Hunt, and my old buddy Lee said, why can't I stay in the book as a hero or something? And I said, you always kill me off. And I said, don't complain, I made you famous.
As I mentioned in the introduction, there are 5 series that you do. And that gives you a lot of leeway, I would think, to work with different characters and sometimes have them interchange and show up in books and not show up in books. But you, even for a writer of series fiction, you do perhaps have more latitude than most who write in that genre.
Yeah, well, that's true. And then the trick is, after 40 years and 55 books, it gets harder to come up with a plot I haven't used before. I'll be writing a line of dialogue, and I'll say, oh, hell, I used that same line 6 books back. So it's trying to, make it always interesting. And as you say, I like the historical part to start it off with. And then hopefully, what's interesting about my writing is, unlike other authors, that I have my beginning, my historical end, the first third of the book, and I have an ending to work towards. But very often, I don't have a middle when I start, and it just seems to develop.
Robert B. Parker, the great mystery novelist, used to tell me that the thing that keeps you honest is the fans. That if you write that line that perhaps you wrote 6 books ago, it could go past you, it could go past the people who read it the first couple of times, it could go past an editor, but invariably it would not go past the readers.
Well, it's hard to say because I think it was Night Probe. I ended the book by having Pitt, the situation at the end develop in the Dulles airport. And then I thought, no, Kennedy works better. So I made him, the end where he's Kennedy. And at the very, very last sentence in the end, he gets in his Ford Cobra and drives off towards the lights of Washington. Now, that's only 400 miles, and nobody ever picked me up on that.
But and it makes you more cautious, I assume, in the future.
Yes, it does. There again, I remember in Iceberg, I referred to a boy and a girl as identical twins, and it doesn't hardly work that way.
The National Underwater and Marine Agency that you write about, NUMA, became real and became a nonprofit organization which was dedicated to locating these long-lost vessels and obviously to help preserve maritime and naval history. What was it that said, okay, I can, that you could achieve this and to make it real?
Well, I started because it intrigued me when I found out that John Paul Jones' ship, the Bonhomme Richard, had never been found. And so that started it, and it just, I was hooked. I went back the next year, and then I started looking for the Confederate submarine, the Hunley, and eventually found that one. I still haven't found the Bonhomme Richard, and we've covered 1,100 square miles. But it just became a challenge, and so many of the ships had such a great history. A fellow called me, and he said, "Would you like to go down in the Titanic?" And I said, "I'm kind of tired of the Titanic." And he said, "It only cost you $30,000." I said, "No, it won't. I'm not going." And I got to thinking, all this stuff about Titanic, what about the Carpathia, this marvelous story of the ship that raced to pick up the survivors? And I thought it was probably scrap, and then I researched it out and found it was torpedoed in World War I off Ireland. So we nailed it on the third try. And and the Mary Celeste, the great ghost ship that was found floating with nobody on board. We found that one, and that was a great thrill. So sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. Shipwrecks are never found when they want to be found, and when they are found, they're never where they're supposed to be.
And I guess a lot of times it has to do with the motive behind finding it. I mean, you're a nonprofit organization, which is different than many other groups that are out looking for this stuff.
Yeah, I know my accountant thinks I belong in a rubber room under restraint because I've never looked for treasure. So, no, it's history with me, and I just enjoy it. And I'm the only one that's out there for nonprofit, I guess. Everyone else wants to find, a treasure chest of gold.
So let's take the Hunley for example. 1995, you discover it. It's this Confederate submarine that had been lost since 1864 in the Charleston Harbor. Finding that, what do we learn from that?
Oh, there's so much in the Hunley. Number one, that was the first submarine in history to ever sink a warship when it blew up the frigate Housatonic, but it never came back. It was lost and nobody knew what happened to it. And we finally started searching in areas, which didn't seem likely, and that's when we really stumbled onto it. My director there of the expeditions, Ralph Wilbanks, I had to go home and write another book to pay for all this foolishness. And he called me at 5 a.m. He said, "Well, we're not going to look for the Hunley anymore." And I said, "Oh, are you giving up?" And he said, "No, we found it." Quite a surprise. And then a fellow by the name of Warren Lash really got behind it, got millions, and they built a conservation lab. And then in 2000, they raised it, and she's now sitting in a tank being conserved.
And does that help inform future books and add to your knowledge base in writing about this character and writing about all the characters?
Oh, I suppose one rubs off on the other a little bit. I've never really used I haven't used much at all on the actual history and putting in my books. I'll refer to something. I did use the Titanic in one, but so many of the restrooms, I just took a ship and, maybe dreamed it up from what I knew about other wrecks. And it's fun to come up with a twist, just like, shoot, I forget the name of the book, so many know. But the ship sinks in this horrendous storm. And in the end of the book, it turns out it's not in the ocean. It sank in Lake Superior, which has storms that are equal and worse, too, than the ocean. Sailors, saltwater sailors will say that the Great Lakes are worse because in the ocean, the storm and the wind come from one direction. And like the Great Lakes, it can come from one direction 10 minutes, and 10 minutes later, it's from another direction. And that's like what sent the Edmund Fitzgerald to the bottom.
Numa was also responsible for discovering the remains of the General Slocum, the worst maritime disaster in New York City history.
Yes, we did. We studied that one. And the amazing thing about that, and same thing with a book or a ship called the Sultana that sank off Memphis and killed, they figure, maybe 2,000, was the fact that people would rather burn alive than drowned. It was just like they wouldn't jump in the water to be rescued. They just stayed on the ship and were burned. So, but we did find the what was remains of the General Slocum down off New Jersey later on.
You mentioned, of course, all of the series, and the Mediterranean Caper is being re-released, but the brand new book, a novel from the Numa Files, is Zero Hour, which is a Kurt Austin adventure, and it's written with Graham Brown. You have taken to write with co-authors. Does that come with age at a point where you like to be more of the idea guy?
No, it just it was the publisher that came after me. They said, "Can you do another book? You know, like a couple of characters like Dirk Pitt and Al Giardino." And I said, "Well, I guess." So I got another author, and we worked together and came up with Kurt Austin and Joe Zavala. And then pretty soon they asked, you know, another one, and the Oregon, which was this ship. It's a tramp steamer, but underneath it's this exotic, you know, weapons and Van Gogh paintings hanging on the bulkheads. And then I always wanted to do a Western, but I didn't want to do one with stagecoaches, cowboys, bandits, and all that. I made it in 1906, so I could use old automobiles, old motorcycles, threw in the San Francisco earthquake. And that's now an Isaac Bell, the detective series. And then I thought there's no husband and wife series out there. So then we created a couple that goes around and they look for treasure, the Fargos, Remy and Sam. So it's kind of a fun thing to, you know, have these various avenues to you know, try other things.
And in the more recent Dirk Pitt novels, you write with your son.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was, he had an MBA, and then he was a financial expert for 13 years. Analyst, I'm sorry. And he got tired of it. He just said after 13 years, he couldn't do it anymore. So I said, okay, why don't you write a Dirk Pitt book? He said, well, I can't do that. And I said, sure you can. I'll help you. And so he did a really nice job on Black Wind, which was the first one, which showed that he could write. So he's written, I think, the next four, and now he's on the fifth.
Genetics, right?
Well, I think actually, basically, he's a better writer than I was. But, you know, I like to think there's some genetics there.
When you look at your career as a whole and this body of work that you have currently, what are you proud of?
Oh, I guess the perseverance more than anything, because in the beginning, I just, you know, the year went by and another year went by, three. But my agent took him 3 years to get me published, bless his soul, Peter Lampack. And so that was it, was the perseverance of hanging in, because people, after Raise the Titanic, they'd say, congratulations on your overnight success. And I'd say, yeah, 11 years. So it really is. I'm where I am, and it's just amazing to me, probably more than anyone.
Well, the reissue of the first Dirk Pitt novel is The Mediterranean Caper. It is published by Putnam. The newest new book is Zero Hour, a novel from the Numa Files, a Kurt Austin adventure, also published by Putnam. Clive Cussler, thank you so much for being with us. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe. I really have been thankful.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.